Welcome to the Western Magazine Hour. Stories and articles about the American West. Produced at the Recording Library of West Texas.
Hello, this is Michael. I'll be reading the Western Magazine Hour. Before we begin, one quick note. The Cowboys and Indians magazine that Jack reads and the True West magazine that I read a few times a year are published bimonthly. So it's one magazine for 2 months. That's happened in this case with both our magazines, who published February-March editions. So once again, I'm going to, for this broadcast, read archives from the True West magazine. Next week, we will begin the April edition of both Cowboys and Indians, narrated by Jack, and the new April True West magazine that I'll narrate. This is from the March 1988 edition of True West. The Terror of the Overland by Roy Odell. According to a story handed down from Montana's gold rush days, in 1863, a tenderfoot, fresh from the east, stood in a bar room in Virginia City, gazing at a gun-belted desperado who was loudly proclaiming that he was a wolf and it was his night to howl. "To hell with the strangers," the agitated man shouted. "I say and do what I please. Whenever that bunch of white-livered curs don't like it, let 'em come and tell me so. Set 'em up for the house, barkeep. This is on me. And any son that don't drink, I'll slice off his ears like I did once before." "Who is that?" timidly asked the tenderfoot. "That Slade of the Overland," whispered a bystander. "The fellow who killed Jules Finney of Julesburg and cut off his ears. Nice chap when he's sober, but a holy terror when he's drunk. So steer clear of him." Slade of the Overland. For years, that name conjured up fear along the Rocky Mountain stage routes. And most men, some of whom were killers themselves, walked wide of him. One who failed to do so, Jules Finney, did indeed suffer an agonizing death at the hand of this notorious hard case. The Jack Slade Jules Benny story began in the late 1850s. In Julesburg, a remote trading post and stage stop in northeastern Colorado Territory. The town got its name from Benny, a French-Canadian trapper and trader who settled there in the early 1850s. When migrations of land seekers, fur trappers, buffalo hunters, and prospectors began making heavy traffic through the area a few years later, Benny built a trading post on the south bank of the Platte River, about a mile east of the junction of Lodgepole Creek. Julesburg was successively named Jules Ranch, Jules Station, Jules Trading Post, and California Crossing, before a name finally stuck. In the early summer of 1859, the Leavenworth and Pikes Peak Express Company established a route through the town, and Benny was appointed a station keeper. But soon, company officials realized their choice was a poor one. From nearly the first day, horses and other company property began to disappear. Benny was suspected of having a hand in the losses, but the company could not uncover any concrete proof. By October 1859, when the Central Overland California and Pikes Peak Express Company took over the route, the situation had become quite serious. Stage schedules were continuously interrupted. Large numbers of horses were disappearing, and the route was deteriorating. Overland officials issued an order to clean up the line. Enter Jack Slade, the man picked to do the job. Joseph Alfred Jack Slade was a native of Carlisle, Illinois, and a member of a prominent family, his father having served a term in Congress. But despite a proper upbringing, Jack developed an early reputation as a roughneck. Although it was never proven, legend tells when he was barely a teenager, Jack killed a local man, one Gottlieb, during an argument by hitting him in the head with a rock. According to the story, Jack fled to Texas, where he stayed for some time, after which he joined the army for the war with Mexico. During the war, Jack supposedly led a dangerous mission in which he killed 9 of the enemy. While these tales were told over and over again during Slade's lifetime, apparently with his blessing, the only fact that has been verified was that he did serve in the military during the Mexican War. After the war, Slade married a handsome woman named Maria Virginia. He worked mostly in the freighting business, and the couple moved around a lot. It was during this period that Jack developed into a truly dangerous character, especially when he had too much to drink, which was frequently. On a trip through what is now Wyoming, he reportedly shot a drinking companion, a teamster named Andrew Farrer, merely because Farrer, also drunk, had dared him to do so. Filled with remorse on sobering up, Slade immediately sent for a doctor, but Farrer could not be saved. In the 1850s, Slade hired on with the express firm J.M. Hockaday and Company, which needed men of his caliber to get mail deliveries through rough country. Slade met the challenge. He knew the Western trails, was fearless, and he was an expert gunman. When the Hockaday Company was bought up by Leavenworth and Pike's Peak Express, which in turn was taken over by Overland, Slade was made division superintendent between Julesburg and South Pass, Wyoming Territory. When Slade arrived in Julesburg in late 1859, conditions involving Jules Benny were at their worst. Schedules were still not being met. Mail was being misdirected, and it was rumored that Jules himself was stealing the company's horses. Not long after his arrival, Slade confirmed this through a surprise visit to Jules' ranch. On learning of the accusations, Benny swore vengeance against Slade, but did not confront him, choosing instead to stay out of his way and bide his time. Slade did likewise, gathering more evidence. Finally, in the spring of 1860, the two men met at an Overland station 50 miles west of Julesburg. Slade had come along, and on reining up, stepped down from his buckboard to talk to an acquaintance, a man named Tom Bryan. Jules, inside the station store, spotted the two men sitting on a stack of wagon hubs. Slade probably had brought a rifle, but may have left it in the buckboard. Noticing that Slade was unarmed, Benny decided that it was time to make his move. After concluding his conversation with Bryan, Slade began walking toward the store. As he neared the door, Benny stepped out and began firing his revolver. At such close range, Benny could hardly miss, and it is believed he hit Jack with 5 balls. Not satisfied with this, Benny raced back inside and returned with a shotgun, which he emptied into the helpless Slade as he lay on the ground. Jules was then heard to say, "There he is, boys. When he quits kicking, bury him in a dry goods box. I'll pay for it." According to witnesses, Benny's words revived Slade, who groaned, "Like hell you will." Struggling to sit up, Slade shouted at the departing Benny, "When the time comes, which it ain't yet, I'll tend to my own funeral. For that, though, I'll tend to yours. But with no ears on you, 'cause I'm gonna cut them off and wear them on my watch chain." Assuming that Slade was as good as dead, Jules loaded up his wagon and headed west for Rocky Ridge country. But Slade did not die. Friends summoned an army surgeon from Fort Laramie, who removed half a handful of lead from Jack's body. Then, although as near death as anyone could be, Jack hung on and was transported to St. Louis for further treatment. Within the year, he recovered and was back supervising his division. Jules, in the meantime, had gone into the cattle business in another part of the territory. It would be nearly a year before the two would face each other again. Sometime the following year, Benny turned up at the Overland Cold Spring Station, west of Julesburg, and let it be known that the next time he saw Slade, he would finish the job. Slade, in the meantime, had other problems to contend with. Indian trouble broke out along the line, especially in southern Wyoming, and the company transferred Slade further west to supervise the route north of Fort Collins, near what is now the Colorado-Wyoming state line. There, near the center of his new division, Slade built a new stage station and ranch house, which he christened Virginia Dale, after his wife. Although Slade was kept busy by his duties, Jules Benny probably was never far from his thoughts. There are several versions of what happened when the two enemies finally did meet again. According to one account, when Jack learned that Jules had returned to Cold Springs, He and two friends armed themselves with shotguns and boarded an eastbound stage. When they pulled up at Cold Springs, Benny was in the station store. Seeing Slade up top with the driver, Jules ran outside and to the rear of the building, apparently hoping to get a shot at Jack as he approached the store. Slade's friends, however, working their way around the building from opposite directions, soon got the drop on Jules. Now it was Slade's turn. He ordered his men to take Jules to the corral and tie him to a post. There, Slade reportedly said to Benny, "You made me suffer. Now I'll pay you for it." With that, he shot Jules once in the arm and walked away. Minutes later, after downing a stiff drink, Slade returned, took aim, and put another ball into Benny. Then left again. This went on for over an hour. After each drink, Slade would return and shoot Jules again, making sure that none of the shots were fatal. Despite losing much blood, Jules stubbornly held on to life. This seemed to irritate Slade, or perhaps he merely tired of the fun. Finally, he walked up, placed his gun at Benny's head, and put an end to the saga. As the life drained out of Jules, Slade cut off the Frenchman's ears and nailed them to the post. Later, he returned and put one in his pocket. During the following months, the story of the killing, often with embellishments, was told and retold along the overland. Slade encouraged three yarns, and often he whipped out a human ear to pass along among the drinking companions. Before long, Slade became a bigger-than-life character, possibly the most famous among the many hard cases that frequented the Rocky Mountain frontier during those years. Eventually, Slade's fame would spread to every state in the Union. Mark Twain, who met him during his first venture west, would devote two chapters to him in his popular book, Roughing It. And Sir Richard Burton, the noted British explorer, would write of him in his memoirs of his trip to America. The story of the killing of Jules Benny was pretty much accepted as fact. But as the years went by, a different version unfolded. This account was offered by two friends of Slade's, Nelson Vaughn and John Frey. According to Vaughn and Frey, Slade did not go after Benny himself, but offered $500 to anyone who would bring Jules to him alive. Vaughn and Frey claimed they took Jack up on the offer and, after a brief skirmish, subdued the Frenchman. But in the process, Jules was badly wounded. Vaughn and Frey loaded him on a pack horse, but before they could get to Slade, Benny died. Fearful of losing the reward, the two men brought the body in anyway and tied it to a snubbing post in a sitting position, telling Slade they had indeed got his man. But when Slade saw Jules, he said, "This man is dead." Vaughn reportedly replied, "Nah, he's only playing possum." "I'll see whether he's playing possum," Slade said, and he took out his knife and cut off an ear. When Jules did not flinch, Slade said, "That proves it, but I might just as well have the other ear." Slade then stuck the ears in his pocket and walked away, leaving Vaughn and Frey to dispose of the body, minus the reward money. Regardless of what actually happened at Cold Springs Station that day, Slade apparently accepted responsibility for Benny's death. It is recorded that Jack went to Fort Laramie and surrendered to the commanding officer. After reviewing the case, the Army brought no charges. Overland officials also conducted an investigation and, as expected, found Slade's actions justifiable. In fact, the company gave Slade a promotion of sorts by extending his authority on the line to Salt Lake City. Slade was now in charge of some of the worst Indian country along the route, but he met the challenge as he did others facing pioneer stage travel of the day. Blizzards, floods, rock slides, whatever came up. The stages went through, and often they reached their destination ahead of schedule, such was the driving force of the man. But Jack Slade's weakness for whiskey began to get the best of him. According to witnesses, Jack could not handle his liquor. Worse than that, he became a demon when drunk, frequently shooting up whatever saloon he was in. But while Slade did more than his share of imbibing, He did not tolerate drinking by overland drivers while they were on duty, nor did he tolerate local merchants selling his men whiskey during working hours. In October 1862, Slade and three companions wrecked a store at LaPorte, Colorado, and beat up the owner, who had been supplying whiskey to overland drivers. Slade later reimbursed the merchant for the damage, but charges were filed and Jack was arrested. He posted bail but did not appear for his hearing. The overland had no choice but to fire him. Out of a job, Slade tried freighting again and eventually drifted to Virginia City, Montana, where he and Maria Virginia purchased a small ranch about 8 miles east of town on Trail Creek. Here, Jack built a small stone house, and farther north, along the Madison River, he bought 320 acres of pasture land and stocked it with milk cows. Slade could have done well financially in the rapidly growing Virginia City area, but within a short while, he was spending less and less time at his ranch and more time in saloons. More troublesome than ever when drunk, Slade became a major problem in town. It was not unusual to see him ride his horse into a saloon or store, threaten the owner and insult the customers, and demolish the place. When he sobered up, he would usually apologize and pay for the damages, but he was beginning to get on the townspeople's nerves. He was told more than once that either he would observe law and order or he would have to pay the consequences. Each time he gave his solemn promise that he would behave. But then some of his old friends from the overland would arrive in town and he would forget his promise. On New Year's Day, 1864, Slade and several drinking pals did considerable damage to a saloon for which they did not pay. Then on January 8th, they demolished the parlor in one of Virginia City's popular sporting houses. The next morning, Jack continued his reign of terror. Frequenting one saloon after another, Slade insulted customers and picked fights. That night, he stormed into the local theater during a ballet and ordered the star to take off her clothes. The embarrassed audience, which included many married men and their families, promptly walked out and the performance was canceled. Still going strong the following morning, Slade ran a milk wagon off the road, spilling the contents. Nervous merchants locked their doors and drew their shades. Virginia City Sheriff Jim Fox sought out Alexander Davis, judge of the local people's court, which had recently been instrumental in the demise of the famous plumber gang of horse thieves and road agents. Davis issued warrants for the arrest of Slade and several of his companions. When the warrants were served, Slade and his friends snatched the papers from Fox's hands and tore them up. Sheriff Fox, apparently not eager to take on Slade and his pals himself, rode down the gulch to Nevada City and found Captain James Williams, leader of the vigilantes that, just the year before, had put an end to the plumber crowd. A meeting of the Vigilance Committee was quickly called, and over the objections of several of Slade's friends, a vote was taken to bring Slade's violent career to an end. Jim Kissenden, a good friend of Slade, hurried to warn him and to persuade him to leave town. Slade agreed to leave, but asked to borrow Kissenden's Derringer for added protection. Kissenden reluctantly gave Slade the gun, and Jack mounted his horse and started down the street. But when he reached Fouts and Russell's store, which served as Judge Alexander Davis's courtroom, Jack, who was still balmy from booze, reined up, went inside, and shoved the Derringer in Davis's face, proclaiming that he was taking him hostage. A bystander, William Hunt, managed to quiet Slade down and talk him into leaving. But with this act, Jack had sealed his doom. Slade, beginning to sober and realizing his plight, ran back into Fouts and Russell's and apologized to Judge Davis. But it was too late. Captain James Williams placed Slade under arrest and informed him that the committee had sentenced him to hang. Judge Davis, however, began to soften and suggested that Jack be banished from Virginia City instead. But Williams informed Davis that his duties were over and that the sentence was to stand. In a final plea, Slade begged that he be allowed to see his wife, but his request was denied, and he was promptly marched down the street to a corral where a beam had been laid across high gateposts. A dry goods box was shoved under Slade's feet, and a rope was placed around his neck. A crowd had gathered, and a handful of Jack's friends began protesting, but they quieted when the vigilantes leveled their guns. Captain Williams gave the order, and the box was kicked away. The fall was just 30 inches, but it was all that was needed. Jim Kiskenden cut down his friend's body and took it to the Virginia Hotel. Moments later, Maria Virginia Slade arrived. Seeing her dead husband, she threw herself on his body and cursed his killers. "Where were his friends?" she cried. "How could his friends let this happen?" Vowing that Jack's body would never be buried in Montana soil, Mrs. Slade had him placed in a zinc-lined casket filled with alcohol. After the roads became passable in the late spring, she had the body taken to a Salt Lake City cemetery. Jack Slade, foremost of the early frontier rogues, lies there today. True West Magazine, March 1988 edition. Buffalo Hunting in Fort Griffin by Charles M. Robinson III. The close of the Red River War in 1875 opened the entire Texas Plains to the buffalo hunters. The leaders of that Indian uprising had been deported to Florida. The tribes themselves were confined to Indian territory, and Fort Elliott was established in the Texas Panhandle to make sure they stayed there. Now the hunters could operate on a much wider front, sweeping the plains like a scythe. This changed the most convenient marketing center from Dodge City to Fort Worth, and the place offering the most convenient access both to the hunting grounds in the west and to Fort Worth in the east was Fort Griffin. Thus, the center of the Texas hide trade moved from adobe walls to Fort Griffin, and the legend of the Flat, as the town at Fort Griffin was called, was born. On Christmas 1874, even as the Army was still mopping up from the Red River campaigns, 20-year-old Joe McCombs led the first hunting expedition out of Fort Griffin. Despite his youth, McCombs was already an experienced frontiersman, having come to the Flat 2 years earlier. He got some idea of the vast extent of the southern buffalo herd in the fall of 1872 while working on a railroad survey west of Belknap. The party encountered a herd which members estimated at 50,000 head, and at one point he got caught up in a stampede. Now, 2 years later, McCombs was hunting hides with John Jacobs and John William Poe as skinners. "From the low ground, I would creep, hunting afoot, and getting into scattered bunches of 10 to 100 head," McCombs recalled. "I would always shoot the leader of the herd, usually a bull, and if I could get him, the bunch or herd would start milling until another assumed leadership, and I headed out, and then I would try to get him. The idea always being to keep shooting while they were milling, but to get a leader in order to keep the milling going on." Most of the buffalo had gone farther south at the time of that year, but in 2 months, McCombs managed to kill 700. They returned with the hides to Griffin, then headed farther west beyond Fort Phantom Hill. This time, they stayed out until May 1st and got 1,300 hides. At the end of the season, they sold 2,000 hides at Griffin at $2 each for robe hides and $1.50 for others. They were the first hides of any consequence marketed at Fort Griffin, according to McCombs. It didn't take long to catch on, and in 1875, the Moore outfit was ready to hunt from Fort Griffin. Before leaving the post, the commanding officer, Colonel George P. Buell, told Wright Moore to stay within 20 miles, since the military still feared Indian trouble. In fact, Wright later recalled that Buell threatened him with the rest if he strayed beyond. "My brother was behind, and when he caught us, he asked what Buell had said. I told him, but that he would never come after us. We all had those Sharps big 50s and could have made quite a stand." The Moors had perfected the buffalo hide trade, and in some ways were directly responsible for the Red River War. They were the Rockefellers of the hide business, having elevated it to an industry. And their operation made Joe McCombs's pioneering effort of a few months earlier seem like nothing more than a camping trip. The outfit had 16 wagons, and Wright Moore hired 9 outlaws to work it. "I worked outlaws a good deal," he explained. "You never saw a lazy one. When one is down and out and tells you he wants to work, he will work, attend to his business, and make a good hand as long as he is with you. I got some of them in Griffin and some out in the brush, and then I pulled out 140 miles from the fort." So much for Buell's orders. Moore may have trusted outlaws, but others didn't. Writing of them in 1874, Cornelia Adair, whose husband John became Charles Goodnight's partner at the J.A. Ranch, commented, "Many of these men are the roughs of the frontier, criminals flying from justice, notorious ruffians and murderers, and the settlers are more afraid of them than the Indians." Hunter and lawman Henry Herron had mixed feelings. Most of the buffalo hunters were all right, regardless of what had been written about them. However, there were some tough ones amongst the skinners of the range. A lot of them were refugees from justice and out there to avoid arrest. Fort Griffin was the closest town to Buffalo Range, and there was little law out there. During 78 and 79, Shackelford County had attached to it, for judicial purposes, 13 counties to the west, but did not have an officer on the Buffalo Range. One bad character that drifted into our camp, whom I was later to assist in trailing down and arresting in Coleman County, was one D. McDonald, a member of the McDonald Brothers gang that committed a brutal murder at Old Fort Belknap. By and large, though, most men on the range were professional hunters and skinners and went about their business with a ruthless efficiency that would do any assembly line proud. The hides poured into Fort Griffin, and the buffalo hunters had money to spend in the stores and the dives of the flat. The period of 1876 to 79, when the hunt was in full swing, was probably the most prosperous time in the brief history of Fort Griffin. The men who cashed in most were the suppliers, and the greatest of them was Frank E. Conrad, a native of Rockford, Illinois. Conrad had been taken to Tampa, Florida as a child. Upon the death of his parents, he was brought to San Antonio to live with an aunt and uncle. There, he learned the merchant's trade as a store clerk in his uncle's store. Shortly after the war broke out, he joined Hood's Texas Brigade and served until the end. Conrad was about 24 years old when he was appointed post trader at the newly reactivated Fort McCavitt, just north of what is now Interstate Highway 10 near Sonora. 2 years later, he moved to Fort Griffin to assume the same position there, and so was able to get in on the ground floor when the buffalo boom started. Meanwhile, Charlie Rath had expanded his interests from Kansas to Fort Griffin and teamed up with Conrad to form Conrad and Rath. The company had a warehouse and magazine attached to the store where it kept 30 tons of lead and 5 tons of powder. One hunting party, which came through the store in 1876, included a tall, lanky fugitive from family problems named Pat Garrett. Garrett, who would later gain fame as the man who killed Billy the Kid, was a hunter for a party which also included Skelton Glenn, Luther Duke, and Joe Briscoe. He bought a Winchester from Conrad at $50, while the others paid $56 apiece for sharps. They also bought ammunition and provisions, all of which the firm supplied. Conrad and Rath not only outfitted the hunters, they bought and shipped the hides, thus making money both ways. But while they were the biggest, they were not the only outfitters in the flat. Rival F.B. York & Company offered highest cash prices paid for hides and furs. Others were William McCamey, T.E. Jackson, and E. Frankel. On the opposite end, Fort Worth, the firm of Gurley & Company served as commission and hide merchants, receiving as many as 1,000 hides from the Galveston Exchange. For recreation, the flat offered gamblers saloons and soiled doves to help the hunter forget the hard months on the plains and to relieve him of his well-earned cash. I've seen men and women dancing there in the dance halls without a bit of clothing on, Hunter J.W. Woody recalled. Harry Heron observed the buffalo hunters and their skinners, the drovers and the cowboys going up the trail, had plenty of money to spend, and they spent it recklessly. For instance, a year or so after I arrived in Fort Griffin, I saw a buffalo hunter come to town one day and market his season's kill for $1,500, and the next morning he had to borrow money for his breakfast. The gamblers had gotten all of it. The ordinary fellow did not have the ghost of a show in those gambling halls. Most all of the games were crooked, and if they could not get it one way, they would get it another. Frequently, they would get their victims drunk and roll them and take it away from them in that way. The back of every saloon was a gambling hall, and there were so many saloons that the number I have given at this time, 8 or 10, is just my recollection. The number varied from time to time. But the hunters themselves were not innocents. In one case, in 1875, the sheriff of Young County came to Fort Griffin to get a local tough named Buffalo Bill. As J.W. Woody remembered, they were both crack shots. They met there at Fort Griffin, and Bill knew he had come to arrest him. Both had Winchesters. They were about 10 feet apart and had their guns held pointing at each other from their hips. The sheriff said, "Bill, lay your gun down or I'll have to shoot." Bill pulled the trigger and hit the sheriff in the heart, while the sheriff's shot hit Bill in the middle of the forehead. Even the range was not safe. In addition to Indians and outlaws, hunters had to contend with each other. It was a hard, often frustrating life. They got on each other's nerves, and sometimes someone would crack. Pat Garrett learned this the hard way in November 1876. The hunting had been poor for a while, and cold, damp weather had set in. Garrett was chafing on his legs and was depressed and moody. Joe Briscoe had gone down to wash his clothes in an arroyo and had come back with fingers frozen and mumbling to no one in particular about being unable to get anything clean in the muddy water. Garrett answered with a remark about Irish intelligence, or lack of it. Briscoe, a solid Irish Catholic, started swinging and was promptly knocked into the mud by the 6-foot-5-inch Garrett. Briscoe got on his feet and was again sent sailing into the mud. After the scene had been played several times, Garrett tried to extricate himself. By now, though, Briscoe was in a complete rage and went after him with an axe. Running as hard as he could, Garrett managed to grab his rifle, then turned and fired into his pursuer. The impact sent Briscoe spinning into the campfire, mortally wounded. The frightened Garrett grabbed a horse and took off into the plains. He returned the next day, and after consulting with his companions, decided to ride into Griffin and turn himself in. Within a few days, he was back, saying the authorities had declined to prosecute. Whether Garrett actually turned himself in is a matter of conjecture. Given his record, he probably did, and given their record, the officials in Griffin simply wrote it off as just another killing on the plains. The basis of this world of violence, money, and hardship was the hunt, which continued unabated and with brutal precision. When the railroad reached Fort Worth on July 4, 1876, shipping became all the easier, and as the 1876 season got underway, the industry really boomed. The Jacksboro Frontier Echo, which covered the news from Fort Griffin, predicted big business in hides for fall and winter in 1876. On November 1st of that year, the Fort Worth Democrat carried this notice. From the West, freighters wanted. The buffalo hunt, the largest ever known. The hides coming to Fort Worth. Fort Griffin, November 7th. Freighters are wanted to transport buffalo hides to Fort Worth. The hunt is the largest ever known. Countless thousands of buffalo cover the prairies. 10,000 hides are now on their way to the railroad and thousands await transportation to Fort Worth. Some 1,500 hunters were out on the plains that season, Joe McCombs remembered. Buffalo hunters were coming in pretty thick. The northern hunters were following the herds on their migration south. All the time now, the herds were being drifted west by the hunters who were hard after them from morning till night. We could hear the guns of other buffalo hunters occasionally, but most of them were to the east of us. I always tried to keep on the outer edge. By early spring, hides were stacked on some 4 acres around the flat. All the space not occupied by houses was covered with ricks of buffalo hides, representing the winter's hunt, ready to be transported to Dallas, Denison, or Fort Worth, 150 to 200 miles distant, Edgar Rye said. A variety of rifles was being used to bring in this tally of hides. When the industry first began out of Dodge City, the best rifle was the 50 caliber Springfield, designed as an infantry weapon. This was replaced in 1873 by the 45-70. But according to Wright Moore, they were too light. And I wrote to Sharp that we wanted a heavier bore. He said a larger one would not be true, but he made this heavier gun. Thus was born the 50 caliber Sharps, or Big 50, which became the buffalo gun and almost wiped the animal from the face of the planet. Most hunters loaded their own shells, increasing the range by upping the charge. The factory load was 90 grains of powder, but hunters reloaded them as high as 110 grains. Used with a telescopic sight, the effect was devastating. In addition, the Moors loaded theirs by wrapping the bullets in paper instead of greasing them. To prevent a lead buildup inside the barrel, the bullets were made of a concave butt. When the barrels of our guns got so hot they began swelling, the bullets with this concave butt would be expanded when shot by the charge of powder, thus filling the barrel and making it true. Every hunter agreed that it was necessary to kill the leader of the herd. While Joe McCombs and most others contended the leader was generally a bull, J.W. Woody said it was always a cow. If you could shoot that cow with what we called a lung shot, she would trot around a little while and then die. When you got the leader in this way, you had what was called a stand, and the other buffalo wouldn't leave until they had to. If you didn't kill the leader first, they might travel on you. Wright Moore did not specify the leader's gender, although he always used the word he. The leader was not always in the lead of the bunch. Sometimes he would be behind. There was something about him that told me he was the one. Sometimes there would be two or three leaders to a bunch, and sometimes I failed to pick the leader, but as soon as I shot, I could tell whether I had picked the right one or not. If I had not, I quickly threw another cartridge into my gun and killed the leader as soon as I could, so as to get a stand. As soon as I killed him, the others would stop running. Then the slaughter began. A Sharps rifle weighed from 14 to 16 pounds, depending on the caliber. The hunter rested it on his knee, or more often, on a rest stick. He also carried as many as 100 rounds in a double-width belt for the day's hunt. When the hunter went on to another stand, the Skinners moved in. Using their six-shooters, the Skinners killed the wounded. A few motherless calves that had escaped the bullets were knocked in the head. Each Skinner carried two knives and a sharpening steel, and they were artists in their line. With one stroke of the knife, they encircled the hock above the hoof. Then a quick movement of the hand split the hide down each leg and along the animal's belly to the underjaw. Then with a large curved skinning knife, the hide was removed in the incredibly short time from 5 to 8 minutes. In some cases, nothing was saved except the tongues and hides. Consequently, from $15 to $20 worth of fine meat was destroyed to save a dollar hide. After the work of removing the hides was finished, each man carefully wiped his knife and returned it to the scabbard attached to his belt. Then began the operation of salting and rolling the hides, preparatory to hauling them to camp. Some camps were organized to the point of having a specialist called a ripper who would slit the skin and then move on to the next carcass while the Skinner finished the job. According to J.W. Woody, there were men in the country who would skin 100 buffalo a day and do their own ripping. The Anderson and Long outfit, which had a camp at Big Spring, and a man who could skin 100 any day. Not everyone wasted meat. Some parties were meat hunters who would go out in the fall and take the animals for their meat. There was a lot of buffalo meat freighted out of this country, Woody said. S.P. Mary told of making a vat by propping up a hide with four sticks, then packing it with as much as 1,500 pounds of boned meat. This was salted with a little saltpeter added for color, then covered with another hide. After curing for 10 or 12 days, it was smoked in a smokehouse, also made of hides. Freighters with bull teams took the hides to Fort Griffin, where other freighters hauled them on to Fort Worth. You hardly ever saw a team under 18 or 20 yoke of steers and 5 or 6 trail wagons, Woody said. They used them from that on up to 40 yoke of steers and about 10 trail wagons. They freighted both hides and meats. One man drove all those cattle, but they usually had a cook and a herder. The driver rode a pony up and down the line of steers. If he wanted to go to the left, he hollered, "Whoa!" If he wanted them to go to the right, he hollered, "Hike!" Men came out to the range and bought hides right at your camp. We sold nearly all our hides right here on the range. In October 1877, word filtered along the range that a white buffalo had been seen near the Moore camp on the headwaters of the Clear Fork. Frank Conrad offered $100 for the hide. Wright Moore got it on October 7th. It was a 4-year-old cow, which he found in a herd of 4,000. The hide was turned over to a tanner in Dodge City. The peak year was 1877. Joe McCombs struck out in September with skinners, stackers, 1,000 pounds of lead, and 5 kegs of powder. His take that season was 9,700 hides, which he had to sit on since the price was falling. He finally sold them at $1 a hide, which was lucky, considering the price in Galveston was depressed. That was the last year of the big kill and the biggest year for the buffalo hunters in Texas, McComb said. The hunters followed the herd north that summer and back again in the fall. All the time, they were being hunted. Already, the massive slaughter was worrying many people. As early as 1875, a conservation bill to protect the buffalo was introduced in the Texas legislature. To the military, such a bill was unthinkable, since it protected the economy of the warring Plains tribes. Lieutenant General Phil Sheridan rushed to Austin to oppose the bill. Speaking of the hunters, Sheridan told lawmakers, "These men have done in the last 2 years, and will do in the next year, more to settle the vexed Indian question than the entire regular army has done in the last 30 years. They are destroying the Indians' commissary, and it is a well-known fact that an army, losing its base of supplies, is placed at a great disadvantage. Send them powder and lead, if you will, but for the sake of the lasting peace, let them kill, skin, and sell until the buffaloes are exterminated. Then your prairies can be covered with speckled cattle and the festive cowboy, who follows the hunter as a second forerunner of an advanced civilization." The bill was defeated, and the hunters continued to kill, skin, and sell. Soon, as Sheridan had predicted, the plains were covered with speckled cattle and the festive cowboy. True West Archives, March 1988 edition. Richard King, A Man for Texas, by Robert Dyer. The Old West was a land singularly magnificent and unique. The men and women who settled that wild, beautiful land also were unique. They were endowed with an unequaled persistence and gifted with the love of that sprawling wilderness that is hard to comprehend these days. The men who raised cattle were among the boldest and most hard-working of the many vision seekers who poured into the land west of the Mississippi to seek their fortunes. Much has been written about Charles Goodnight, Jesse Chisholm, and others who engraved their names upon the history books with their brave enterprises, herding and raising cattle using little more than natural canniness, determination, blood, and sweat. But of all the great cattlemen, Captain Richard King stands at the head of the list. Much of the history of Texas revolves around this scrappy, square-jawed genius who developed one of the most famous cattle breeds, the Santa Gertrudis. A man with a vision best describes the young Richard King, who in 1852 became known as Captain Richard King when he formed a partnership in a riverboat company that ferried goods up and down the Rio Grande from Brownsville, Texas. Almost any other man would have been content with King's accomplishments at that early age of 27, but not so with this handsome bulldog-jawed brawler. King was born the son of poor Irish immigrants, and at the age of 11, he ran away from New York City, the slum where he had lived. He stowed away aboard a ship bound for the Gulf of Mexico. Having placed himself in a situation that would have defeated an ordinary man, King became as tough as any sailor in the southern waters or on the rough and ready Texas docks. For 11 years, King struggled up in the steamer business, learning the bookkeeping of freight and trade. He earned his pilot's license and the title of captain. When the Mexican War exploded in 1846, King carried equipment and troops on the Rio Grande. Then he formed a partnership with one of his wartime friends, Mifflin Kennedy. Together, they built a riverboat fleet that numbered 22 vessels by the year of 1865. Still, he was not content. No longer needing to claw his way up in the world against difficult odds, he had a burning desire to become a great man before he aged into a gray-headed old fellow who could no longer swing a fist with the stoutest of deck workers. As a bachelor, King had no ties to keep him from reckless pursuits, and like most rogues, when he finally chose a woman, he picked one who was highly cultured and proper. In 1850, Henrietta Chamberlain arrived in Brownsville with her father, a Presbyterian minister. When he met her shortly thereafter, King did not make a good first impression. The Chamberlain family had been living peacefully on a houseboat on the sandy banks of the Rio Grande until their modest waterborne home happened to be in the way of Captain Richard King, who was returning down the river toward the Gulf of Mexico. King cursed a blue streak at the Chamberlains for being so inconsiderate as to block his river. 17-year-old Henrietta bravely scolded the surprise captain for his bad manners and language. King admired her spirit, and in his usual presumptuous manner, he determined he would marry her. It did not require a long look at the imposing, broad-shouldered King to be convinced that he would get anything he went after, including the high-spirited Henrietta. King was known as a man who would not tolerate frustration for long. There is a well-documented story that he kept a huge Irish brawler on his payroll solely to fistfight with him when he needed the release of combat to calm his reckless spirit. Even in his later years, when he finally had his famous Santa Gertrudis Ranch, a huge hand had been cussed out by King, told him, "If you weren't such a rich man and a captain, you wouldn't cuss to me like that." "Damn you," King angrily replied. "Forget the riches and the captain title, and let's fight." The old story says that they fought for half an hour in a slaughterhouse on King's ranch, neither man getting the upper hand. Finally exhausted, they agreed to quit. They shook hands and parted with mutual admiration. On a warm April day in 1852, King and a few friends mounted up and headed for a fair in Corpus Christi, held to attract businesses and settlers. It proved to be a monumental decision for King and ultimately changed his life and the history of Texas. They rode through an area known to the Mexicans as El Desierto de los Muertos, the Desert of the Dead. The area was virtually uninhabited except for herds of wild mustangs. From these mustangs came the American name for the region, the Wild Horse Desert. The whole area was heavily populated as a result of the breeding of horses left behind after the Mexican War. King quickly realized this empty region had more to offer than wild horses. They stopped to water their mounts at 125 miles north of Brownsville at Santa Gertrudis Creek. King looked around at the rich green grass, oak trees, and rainbow of wildflowers. Mesquite trees, prickly pear cactus, and game stretched away as far as the eye could see. King had heard from an old friend, Texas Ranger Gideon Legs Lewis, that the area was a rancher's paradise. As if it was destined, King ran into Lewis when he arrived in Corpus Christi. The men sat down in a local saloon and discussed the possibility of ranching on the Santa Gertrudis Creek. Forming an unusual partnership, King agreed to finance and set up the ranch, while Lewis, who was still a ranger, would supervise and guard it. King knew well that this was a big gamble, just the sort of situation he thrived on. The hardy but meat-poor Texas Longhorns were used mainly for their hides and fat, unless they were driven hundreds of miles away to market. Trail drives were always a big gamble, but over the long run, statistics proved they were profitable ventures overall. A steer worth only $3 in Texas could bring up to $25 or $30 at almost any cattle market. Cattle were prolific, and pay for cowhands was low, about $25 a month, so things looked very interesting to King. Rather than face the possibility of being sued for simply occupying the land and doing what he chose until someone claimed ownership, King sought out the Mendiola family, heirs to the original Spanish land grants in the area. King offered $300 for their 15,500 acres. In July of 1853, the deal was signed, sealed, and delivered. King funneled most of his profits from the riverboat company into the ranch. His next move was to purchase 53,000 acres of prime grassland adjacent to his ranch for $1,800. Rustic quarters were built on a green hilltop near the springs from which the Santa Gertrudis Creek originated. Then a corral was constructed out of mesquite logs. Next followed a group of earthen huts and a stockade and blockhouse that contained a brass cannon. King finally had his men build an earthen dam on a stream near his headquarters, and the Santa Gertrudis Ranch was ready to do business. King performed a masterstroke in staffing his ranch. On a buying trip to drought-ridden Mexico, he bought up all the available livestock. Then, realizing he had left the locals with no means of support, he told them if they would come to work on the Santa Gertrudis, they could build houses of their own, and he would pay them 25 pesos a month, which was equivalent to the $25 a month American cowboys were paid. The Mexicans happily accepted King's offer, with its similarity to the feudal system with which they had long been familiar. They found King demanding and firm, but kind and fair to those in his employment. In return for his interest in their well-being, they gave him their loyalty and became known as Los Quinios, the King people. Then two events changed everything at the young ranch. King's partner, Legs Lewis, who had always been a ladies' man, was shot to death in Corpus Christi by a jealous husband. King was greatly saddened by the death of his old friend, but he immediately incorporated the Santa Gertrudis Ranch in the name of R. King & Company. He found two new partners with capital to invest. One was his riverboat company partner, Mifflin Kennedy. The other was a steamboat captain, James Walworth, who would be a silent partner. On December 10, 1854, King finally persuaded the Reverend Hiram Chamberlain to let him marry Henrietta. It had not been easy. King had to dress formally and court her like a gentleman. He had to be under constant guard not to utter any of his usual sailor's oaths, and he had to attend prayer meetings regularly. But he finally got what he wanted. The couple soon had two daughters, Nettie, born in 1856, and Ella, born in 1858. Then came a son, Richard II, in 1860. The Kings did a lot of entertaining, and one of their new friends was none other than Robert E. Lee, whom King had met while shipping supplies to army posts along the Rio Grande. Lee gave King a word of advice, which King was to make his motto, "Buy land and never sell." Henrietta took over the routine daily tasks, including teaching the children of Los Caneos, and Captain King was free to raise stock and run ranch business. He bought more and more stock, raising the ranch's assets to 20,000 head of cattle and 3,000 head of horses by 1861. King did very little selling during these growth years. The cattle he bought were mostly the rugged and unpredictable Longhorns. Another of his masterstrokes, however, occurred about that time. He began importing blooded Durhams to crossbreed with his Longhorns. The Longhorns were rugged, but lean and provided little meat. The Durhams, on the other hand, provided abundant meat, but could not handle the rugged, dry country. Slowly but surely, King's experiments began to improve the quality of his stock. He called his new breed the Santa Gertrudis after his ranch. Other ranchers who either did not have the money or the foresight to implement such a systemic breeding program were in for much disappointment. In later years, when cattle buyers would pay about 20% more for a Western crossbreed than for a Longhorn. Cattle were selling slowly at the time, and King turned to a breeding program with his horses, too. He crossed the Mexican ranch horse with the English racing horse to produce one of the most famous horses ever to come out of the West, the Western Quarter Horse. King was so meticulous with his breeding methods that he was known to have paid $600 for one particular black stallion that met his exacting demands for breeding stock. By now, Texas was overflowing with cattle, and King was ready to sell top-quality animals. If the railroad had come to Texas in 1861, when things were going so well for the cattle industry, the cattle boom might have started 5 years earlier than it did. What came to Texas instead was the Civil War. Along with the rest of the country, Texas ranchers were thrown into 5 years of misery and chaos. The population of Texas at that time was only about 600,000, and some 60,000 men went off to fight for the Confederacy, while 27,000 others were assigned to defend the state. Most of the cowboys went off to war, leaving the ranchers shorthanded. King served in the war as an agent of sorts. He ran his steamboats up and down the Rio Grande, supplying cotton, cattle, armaments, and livestock. When Union forces became aware of his activities, he put his steamers under Mexican registration, ran up Mexican flags, and continued running supplies. In another far-sighted move, King demanded payment for his smuggling in gold rather than Confederate currency. Marked by death by the Union Army, King had to flee once in late December when a Yankee raiding party attacked the Santa Gertrudis Ranch. Enraged by King's escape, the soldiers made a shambles of the main ranch house. They besieged the Santa Gertrudis for 2 days, locking the Mexican ranch hands up, loading their wagons with stolen goods, and taking horses from the ranch. Then on Christmas Eve, they were alarmed by the approach of unidentified horsemen and fled south. Henrietta King and her children were unharmed. They hurried off to safety at the house of friends on the Nueces River. In February 1864, Henrietta gave birth to another son, whom she named Robert E. Lee King in angry defiance of the Union. King stuck to his daring pursuits until the war ended in 1865. Texas ranchers, including King, then found they had a strange situation on their hands. Texas was drowning in cattle. Several generations had been born, and bulls that normally would have been castrated were allowed to breed freely. Things were in turmoil for a while as cattlemen tried to gather their scattered herds, but the Atchison, Topeka, and Santa Fe Railroad made its way through southern Kansas, spurring the great trail drives to such wild railhead towns as Dodge City, Abilene, and Wichita. The cattle boom was on. And by 1871, at least 70,000 Longhorns were sold in Abilene alone. At the Santa Gertrudis Ranch, Richard King started 1866 with about 84,000 cattle on 146,000 acres. He made annual cattle drives to Kansas railheads. The ranch began to prosper even after the rustlers took their toll. King figured he lost over $1 million worth of stock. in a three-year period after the war when his cattle were scattered all over South Texas. King fortified his ranch against rustlers and outlaws. He frequently had to make business trips from the ranch to Brownsville. To assure safe delivery of his huge payrolls and land purchase money, King had relay stations built along the 125-mile route to Brownsville. At the stations, he posted expert riflemen to guard corrals of fresh horses. Then he traveled fast, carrying his money in a steel safe built into the stagecoach. Escorted by a dozen or more armed riders, he rode inside the coach with a 12-gauge shotgun at his side. Still, King's stagecoach was sometimes attacked. Once the coach was riddled with bullets, and a traveler to whom King had given a ride was killed. The rustlers were finally all but stopped by ranchers and the Texas Rangers by 1876. In the next 8 to 9 years, King built his ranch into a 600,000-acre empire. King's farsightedness again paid off when fences came to Texas. The other cattlemen who had hurriedly created ranches larger than the Santa Gertrudas were horrified by the introduction of barbed wire. But King had long ago realized the only way he could refine his careful breeding methods was to control the animals in fenced pastures. Several years before barbed wire fencing was even invented, King had started building wooden fences around 65,000 acres at a cost of around $50,000. Rather than use his ranch hands to drive cattle to market, King started a profit-sharing program, hiring professional drovers for a flat fee and putting his foremen into limited partnership, which gave each the chance to make more money than the average trail boss. King was so successful by then that he no longer could put his money back into the ranch alone. So he bought the Corpus Christi Free Press, a stagecoach line, the Corpus Christi San Diego and Rio Grande Narrow Gauge Railroad, and an ice-making plant. Richard King, in his mid-50s, was the undisputed king of Texas. He demanded and got royal treatment wherever he went. On his trips to Brownsville, he enjoyed evenings in Celestin's Jagu's Saloon, where he drank his favorite brand of whiskey, Rosebud. He always kept a jug of it close, for by then, he was bothered by a stabbing pain in his stomach. Rosebud eased the pain temporarily, and he went on like that for 2 years. Finally, he was forced to see a doctor, who informed King that he was dying of stomach cancer. King began to put his affairs in order and selected a successor, his youngest son, Robert E. Lee King. King died of pneumonia in St. Louis, and he had already set up his eldest son, Richard II, with his own ranch, so he chose his attorney, Robert J. Kleberg. Kleberg, it so happened, was sweet on King's daughter, Alice. In October of 1884, Kleberg married Alice, and the future ownership of the Santa Gertrudas was settled. King went to St. Louis for the first National Convention of Cattlemen in November 1884, despite his battle with pain from the stomach cancer. He made a brief speech to the convention and returned to the Santa Gertrudas Ranch to die. Early in 1885, his daughter Alice and Henrietta finally persuaded him to put himself under the full-time care of a doctor in San Antonio. Captain Richard King left his beloved ranch for the last time, leaving instructions to keep on buying. The rough and ready, far-sighted genius and king of cattlemen died in San Antonio in 1885. No other cattleman in the industry before or since surpassed the feats of this remarkable man who introduced the Santa Gertrudas cow and the Western quarter horse to the world while carving out one of the greatest empires in the West.
Thank you for joining us for the Western Magazine Hour. Stories and articles about the American West. Your narrator has been Jack. You can hear this program on Recording Library of West Texas Radio and on demand with your computer or favorite mobile device at recordinglibrary.org.